You're listening to the Bethel University Chapel Podcast, recorded from the Everest Rohr Chapel Fine Arts Center in Mishawaka, Indiana. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. It is really good to be here. Man, that made me sound pretty impressive. I'm going to have to say that to my kids as they prepare for my Christmas presents or birthday presents. They'll maybe do something better for me. I want to talk about this book that David and I wrote, Faith for Exiles. There you go. You can kind of see it there in between the, for some reason it doesn't want to stay. There we go. It's a hardback book, so you know it's real. And it's what's inside is really important. But I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the research that we found, taking a look at the faith practices of 18 to 29-year-olds. Now, here's what's really weird for me. This is the first time that I have ever presented this material in the last year and a half since we did it in front of the audience that is entirely made up of the people that we actually were researching. So this is a little intimidating to me. And so you may say, well, Mark, we know all this stuff because we told you this, okay? I want to tell you why studying research and generations is kind of important. Because basically we all live in unique times, and those times shape us more than we realize that they do. For instance, your great-grandparents were part of a generation called the Builder Generation, sometimes referred to as the World War II generation. They had a very different idea growing up about what the future was going to look like. If you look at some of the futurists of that day, Walt Disney, Ray Bradbury, an author, their idea was that if we can build a better external world, if we can have better stuff out here, it will make us happy and satisfied and experience joy in here. So if you look at their writings and the way that they looked at technology, mom was going to come home in her apron and she's, you know, magnificently dressed and she pushes a button of the picture of the meal that she wants to make and the countertops open up and a glass domed thing with a perfect turkey and all of the fixings comes out and she has robot vacuums and that actually happened. And so these were interesting ideas of the future. But if you went to one of your great-grandparents and you said to them, and your mom or dad said, or your grandparents said to them, hey, you know, why don't you ever tell me that you love me? Your great-grandfather might say to your great-grandparent, hey, look in the refrigerator. There's food in there. Look at the roof over your head. I have provided for you, and that is how I have expressed my love for you, by caring for you. And that generation is responsible for most of the benefits that we are enjoying today. They're an incredible generation. There's a lot to learn from them. But their children grew up to be the boomers. Right? Do we have any boomers in the room, by the way, profs or anybody like that? Yeah, you ruined everything that your parents did for us. Thank you. No, I'm kidding. The boomers came along and they said, you know what? It's not the exterior world that we care about. It's the interior life that we're more interested in. We're interested in values like peace, love, and harmony. And so they were the hippie generation, right? And they were interested on the internal experience of life. It was almost a flip reaction to their parents. And then they gave, and they were a massive generation because when all of your great-grandparents came back from World War II, they started having babies like crazy. And so they were a massive generation, one of the most culture-shaping generations that we've had. And then that came what we call the bust generation, or Generation X. That's my generation. We are a smaller generation, and we were defined basically because we were children of the pill. A lot of us were surprises because for the first time, our moms had been able to control their reproductive systems, and they were able to actually try to time when they wanted to have a child. Before that, women had never had any ability to control their contraceptives. So we were a generation of surprises, all right? We kind of like, you know, we were wanted most of the time, just not right now, okay? Because the pill didn't work, you know, 100%. There's a term called latchkey kid that you may or may not be familiar with. We were a generation of latchkey kids because mom, we interrupted that cycle, and so mom was working or pursuing her education or what she wanted to do, which was different than the way things had traditionally been done. And so we were kind of given a key and told to go home, lock the door behind us, and don't answer it for anybody. Now, Some of you in your generation was next to emerge, and that's the millennial generation. The millennial generation was a massive generation. And you were a generation that was being responded to because of my generation, okay? We had experienced kind of a little bit of an emotional distance from our parents to a certain extent as they were pursuing their own agendas, and there was a lot of opportunity for the boomers to make a lot of difference in the world, and so they were out chasing those things, and we were kind of like, you know what? I want to give my kids something better, so we're going to create participation trophies, all right? Now, millennials get blamed for the participation trophy. Nobody ever blames the one who created the participation trophy, and that was my generation, all right? My generation, we grew up, we had to have a work ethic just to watch cartoons, all right? We did not have DVRs. We did not have video cassette recorders. Those weren't even invented when we were children. We had to put our clothes out before we went to bed at night so we could wake up and watch cartoons bright and early. Like, we had to get up, get everything done so we could watch cartoons. Now, you guys grew up, you had channels of cartoons available 24/7 to you, all of this stuff. Our generation, not so much. And we wanted to give that to you because we loved you so, so very much. But you grew up at a time where we actually knew the gender of the baby before it was born. And so that created a whole industry around baby showers and being able to give things and decorate baby apparel. When I was born, my mom said, you had the choice between the avocado green crib and the harvest gold crib. That was it. There wasn't anything else because we didn't know whether you were going to be a boy or a girl. So we had to prepare in a very neutral way. Now we know so much about a baby before it's even born. It's amazing. So this is kind of just shows you how these times and these different things affect different generations and where we grow. Now, a lot of you are actually on the fringe between millennial and Generation Z. Some of you are in Gen Z. Some of you are a little bit further beyond. When you guys were originally born, we called you guys digitals because you were born having never breathed air that did not have Wi-Fi in it. And so you have always known technology and the internet. And so this has been something that you've just always known and has always been there for you. So why am I saying all of this? When I talk to older generations about your generation, they're fascinated because they're getting in touch with what makes you different than them and how they can best help and support your generation. Today, as I share these insights, I want to help you realize how unique and special you are and the time that you live in, but also some of the challenges that are unique to your generation that older generations haven't quite figured out. And if sometimes we've been neglectful in how we've been helping you in your faith journey. So I want to share some of that with you, okay? So let's take a look here. Man, this is like going gangbusters here, all right? The first thing I want to talk about is digital Babylon. This is a term that my friend David Kinnaman, the president of Barna Research, and I coined to describe kind of the atmosphere and the environment that your generation is living in. If we kind of just real loosely compare Jerusalem and Babylon, and this is just a metaphor, metaphors are fragile things, don't read too much into it. But Jerusalem, faith is at the center, it's monotheistic, it's a slower pace. There's the idol is false piety, self-righteousness, and it's kind of a simple life. Babylon, on the other hand, represented something different. Faith was pushed to the margins, it was very pluralistic, there were many gods. It was accelerated and frenetic. The idol was fitting in, being up to speed, the fear of missing out. And there was kind of a bittersweet tension that you were always living in, that this is a great time to be alive, but oh, I long for the old days. And if we look at the difference between Jerusalem and Babylon, just using those as loose metaphors, we can understand a lot of why there is generational tension going on. Because right now, older generations are feeling the loss of Jerusalem-like living. They're sitting there going, man, things aren't like they used to be. We need to make things better again, okay? Or whatever the phrasing might be. And that's something that's not just happening in the United States, it's happening globally, right? This whole kind of populist, nationalist type of movement is happening in countries all over the place. Because of this change, the digital Babylon has created this tension, and it's affected us in our faith too. But let's just take a look at the screen practices here. I don't know what's going on, but it's like, Scott, hop in a slide. It might be better if you guys just advance it for me. If we take a look at the weight of digital Babylon versus spiritual input, if we take a look at this, there's about, your generation typically has about 2,700 hours of screen time annually. And if we take a look at that, the typical 15 to 23-year-old has 153 hours of spiritual content, and the typical churchgoer in that same age range is a little bit under 300 hours of spiritual content. And so this led Dave and I to type two words on a screen that were very powerful, and it was simply this: screens disciple. The church has been trying to figure out how the digital world and the digital age has impacted what they do. We know that publishing, banking, everything has been disrupted. Entertainment industry has been disrupted by the internet. But how has church been disrupted? And it's those two words right there. I walked into my doctor once, and I said, and he greeted me by saying, "What do you think you have?" And I said, "Well, that's a really interesting question. What do I think I have?" I go, "I'm here to have you tell me what I have." And he goes, "Well, I know that you have already Googled every symptom that you have, and you know that you're on a spectrum between almost dying and maybe something mild that you can take a pill for." And I said, "You're right." This idea was, he knew that he was no longer the primary physician in his patient's life, that they had a screen that they were going to first. And the same thing's true with your generation. You're looking and exploring spiritual things before the people that are spiritual leaders in your life are even having an opportunity to speak into it. I remember working with one of the seniors in my small group at my church, and he was pushing back to me on the existence of God, some pretty really great philosophical arguments. Now, I had seen this kid when he was like in an infant carrier, so I knew a lot about him, and I knew he wasn't smart enough to argue with me on the level that he was. So I'm like, where is he getting all of this information? So I wrote down a couple of the words he was using, put them into Google, and sure enough, a page popped up that was how to argue somebody who believes that God exists. And he had absorbed all of the information on these pages, so much so that he was able to argue with me. Now, in the past, what he would have done is he would have said, "Hey, Mark, I'm struggling a little bit with my faith. Could you help me find some answers to questions that I have?" And we would have sat down together and kind of worked through that. Now, on his own, he's having a journey all by himself, and I'm not able to maybe guide him and help him navigate the true and false information that he may be looking at, and he's getting it completely unfiltered without any kind of guidance at all. And this is the reality of the generation, of the generational reality that you're living in. So what David and I found as we looked at 18 to 29-year-olds who considered themselves to be a Christian, which is about 83% of that age group, was this idea of resilient exiles. This idea that just like Daniel and Esther and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and many others in the Bible lived in exile, there is a category of what we call resilient exiles among your generation. And I want to talk a little bit about what that looks like. Resilient discipleship for Dave and I is defined this way: developing Jesus followers who are resiliently faithful in the face of cultural coercion and who live a vibrant life in the Spirit. So when we talk about cultural coercion, we're thinking of people like Esther and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that are facing conflict every day with, how do I live my faith? But how do I live in the world too? How do those two things coexist? Because your generation is experiencing more of that tension than probably any other generation before because of this digital Babylon phenomenon, okay? So we take a look here at, let's go back to that that little block there. Uh, oh, that's it. That was it right there. Kind of, but not really. There, that's the one I'm looking for. Okay. Boy, we tested all this and it was working great. Okay, here we go. There are four kinds of exiles, okay? The one on the far end are the resilient disciples that I'll talk about. But these, every person in this group says, at one time in my life, I considered myself to be a Christian. Okay, so the first group that we look at are what we call the prodigals. Those are ex-Christians. They make up about 22% of the 18 to 29-year-olds that were involved in our research project. Okay, what's interesting about that prodigal group is it's not just that they're not attending church. The real issue here is that they actually say, I no longer identify as a Christian. That is no longer a part of who I believe I am. About 7 years ago, David and I did a similar research project for another book that he wrote, and that number was about 11%. So that number has doubled in less than a decade, just to give you an idea at the pace of change that's happening in our world today among your generation. When we look at nomads, nomads are those who say, you know what? I still consider myself a Christian, but the church really isn't my foundation place for this. These people go to church very infrequently, but they still consider themselves Christians. They make about 30% of that age group. And then there's the habitual churchgoers. Habitual churchgoers go to church with a pretty regular frequency, but when we ask them questions about what they believe, they don't necessarily answer all the questions about Orthodox Christianity, right? They wouldn't necessarily identify Jesus as the Son of God. They may not believe in concepts like atonement and things of that nature. And that's one of the things that sets them apart and makes them different. The other thing is that they would say that even though they go to church pretty regularly, faith is not a central aspect of their life and their identity, even though they're going to church with great frequency. Now, the resilient disciples on the end, they make up 10%. Resilient disciples are unique because they attend church about the same frequency as the habitual churchgoers. So they're going to church about the same, but they also do one other thing in addition to attending church on Sundays related to their church, a small group, a place where they serve or do something. They answer all the Orthodox questions to our satisfaction. They don't have to be 100% on it, but they meet a certain criteria level. And they say that faith is central to their life and the decisions that they make. So we get a little bit of a spread there to see the difference. We believe that those resilient disciples are more like the Daniels, the Shadrachs, the Meshachs, the Abednegoes, the Esthers that we see in our world and in our history. And when we look at them, we see some real differences in the way that they live their life. Take a look at this. This is looking at the screen content of those different categories, all right? When we look, the green block there are the resilient disciples. They take in almost 600 hours of spiritual content compared to the habitual churchgoers that have almost half of that. And then the nomads and the prodigals are almost indistinguishable in terms of how much spiritual content. So there are habits, there are practices that really set these apart. We found that there were five things that really set resilient disciples different from the other groups. And the first thing was the experience of Jesus. Just take a look at this bar graph here. I don't want to bombard you with data, but you get a little bit of an idea here of just how different. That green bar represents the resilient disciples. Remember, the habitual churchgoers go to church as frequently as the resilients, okay? They just answer some of the questions differently. But look at that. I believe living in relationship with Jesus is the only way to find fulfillment in life. Look at the gap between the resilient disciple and the habitual disciple. My relationship with Jesus brings me deep joy and satisfaction. They're having very different experiences of Jesus. Following Jesus shapes my whole life, body, mind, heart, and soul. Love God with all your heart, mind, soul. The resilient disciple, almost 90% say, yeah, that describes me. Almost half of that in the habitual category. So we see that there's a really different experience of Jesus that these resilients are having compared to even the habituals and the other categories. The other thing that really set this generation apart was meaningful relationships. Okay? So, you know, what's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, but also love your neighbor as yourself. What we found is that both of these groups are having really different experiences in their relationships. Take a look here. These are just questions that we ask about belonging at church, connecting to church, having friends that you feel are good friendships at church. And you'll see across the board, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into detail, but you'll see across the board in the questions that we ask, resilient disciples are having a very different horizontal connection with others as a result of their faith than the other category groups. So all of this is just kind of to show that there's something going on among your generation. And we recently, in partnership with World Vision, did a study of 18 to 29-year-old Christians globally in 25 different countries. And this just gives you a picture kind of that. The green represents those resilient disciples. You'll see that in areas like Africa and Asia, there are more resilient disciples. But you'll see that in areas like North America and in Oceania, down in Australia, New Zealand, that part of the globe, that resilience is much less. What does that mean for the future of your generation, for the future of the church? Where will the real thought leaders come from? Where will the bold acts for God be displayed and distributed in the church communities? Probably in some of those areas where there's more resilience than where there's less. But we know that throughout this Bible, God has always used a remnant of believers to accomplish his purpose. And one of the really cool things for your generation that we found in this global study of Gen Z and millennials was this. You have more in common with each other globally than you do with the generations above you. That is a powerful, powerful moment for the church. To think that your generation will meet other people from your generation across the globe and instantly have a strong connection with one another, because you are experiencing a world very similar to one another because of the times that you're living in. And that is going to give you the ability to partner, to do bold and courageous things in a way that probably no other generation of the church has been able to do in their lifetime. So let me share with you a few principles, because I think that one of the most important things that you could do to try and figure out, hey, Mark, I want to be in that resilient category. I want to, like, you know, really experience all that God has for me. Well, we really need to recover the theology of the exile. And not just the theology, but just the practice of the exile in our own lives. Not worrying about trying to go in a time machine and go experience life in the past, but realize that we are here, we are now, and that God is wanting to use us right now in the present moment that we live in. So the first thing is that exiles find their home in God. Exiles find their home in God. What does that mean? You see, when Daniel, when Esther were removed from their place, where did they find their ultimate identity? Philippians 3:20 reminds us that our citizenship is in heaven, that is the place that we actually belong, that our home, our eternal home, is somewhere else. It's not the country, the community, the city that we live in, but it is this kingdom of heaven, and we are living in exile in this world. And you have so much in common with your other citizens that are scattered throughout all of the world. And so we have to recover that mindset. If you put the next one up, 2 Corinthians 5:20, we are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God were making his appeal through us. This idea that in living in exile, something really incredible is happening. We have been given authority to represent God here on earth. We are his ambassadors. We don't represent the earthly nation that we come from. We represent the heavenly nation that we come from. And we have been given great authority to do that and to be representatives of that country. That's part of the theology of the exile. Next slide, please. This is a passage from 1 Peter chapter 2. I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world, as Christians, we should identify with the immigrant, with the foreigner more than any other, because we, by our very nature as God's chosen people, are told to consider ourselves this way. to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day that he visits us. One of the things I have learned and has been a huge encouragement and challenge to me as I've worked with your generation of Christians is this. Next slide. This generation doesn't merely want to know that Christianity is true. They also want to see that Christianity is good. See, older generations, we often want to convince you how right we are, how certain we are of the truth, but sometimes in the process of doing that, we're not good. And that's a problem, isn't it? Your generation is speaking up and saying, hey, it's great that we're true, but let's be good in the way that we're living out and pursuing that truth. That's an important reality for exiles to live in that goodness of the gospel, not merely its truth. Next slide. Exiles take epic risks for God's glory. Think about Daniel boldly standing up and saying, I'm not going to eat the food on the king's table. And so he goes and he works out an arrangement by which they can conduct a test to find out whether or not it's better for him to eat the king's food, which violated God's laws for the nation of Israel at that time, to eat the king's food. And they did a test. They did a comparison, and sure enough, it proved that the diet of the Israelites was actually produced superior results. And so that was an epic risk that Daniel took. Shadrach and Meshach took an even bigger risk when they didn't bow down to the image of gold that Nebuchadnezzar made in Babylon. And as a result, a miracle occurred in front of all of the leaders of the nations. And all in this time, they weren't just about being right. They weren't just about being truthful, but they were also good in what they did. And that gave them incredible favor in the earth because they were good in the approach that they took for doing this. We look at Esther, and Mordecai comes to Esther and he says, you know what? We're gonna get wiped out as a people. That's the threat that's imposing on us. But we also know the promises. And there was a strong sense there that God is going to keep his promise. Somehow he will deliver us. We will not be expunged because God's promised a future for Israel. But he says, maybe Esther, for such a time as this, maybe you get to be a part of that promise. And I would say the same is true for your generation. You have an opportunity to be a part of what God is doing in the world. There's not going to be a lot of you that are willing to live in this kind of a way, in this type of exile, to do the kind of good that's necessary to literally reveal and show the glory and the goodness of God on this earth. But this is my Mordecai moment to your generation, to say, will you trust? Will you trust? And will you do something so good, so true, that it glorifies God in an amazing way? That's the moment that your generation has to live in. The last thing I want to say about being an exile is this. Exiles are instrumental to God's purposes in times of change. Older generations, we're confused by what's going on in the world. It's frustrating to us, and we're trying to get control of something we cannot control. Your generation, though, is living in the midst of it. And God uses exiles in times of change and transition to do amazing things for his glory and to make him known. And that is the time that you are living in. No other generation will experience it the way your generation is experiencing it. Nobody will have the imagination to dream the dreams that your generation will dream as a result of the world that you have been brought up in. No other generation that's gone before you has the ability to share, have a passion around the things that you have passion around, to show, help God show up in places that no other generation has the space to show up in. That is given to you. And we are living in a moment of epic change. And we need a generation that can do some epic things by leaning into the glory of God. Let me pray for you. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for everyone who's sitting in front of me. Every generation has a place. We live in our time. We do the things that you've given for us to do under the sun, and that time under the sun is very limited. And Lord, for these men and women that you have placed in this room today, as they are studying, as they are learning, as they are growing in wisdom, you have put them in positions and places. You've given them eyes to see things that other generations could not see. You've given them dreams that no other generation has dreamed or imagined. And Lord, you've also are revealing yourself to them in ways that have been consistent throughout all generations. So Lord, help us that are older to encourage and equip and empower them. But Lord, give them hearts that are fertile and give them eyes to see the opportunities that sit in front of them to do and to take these epic risks and to make you known in ways no other generation has before. We ask these things in Jesus' matchless name. Amen. Thank you guys very much for letting me come and be with you today. Sorry about the slides.
Thanks for listening to the Bethel University Chapel podcast. Subscribe to the podcast and get more information at chapel.betheluniversity.edu or check us out on the iTunes Store by searching for Bethel University Chapel.